Hello, welcome to episode 121 of the Good Good Golf Podcast. Rod Murray at the controls and preparing to examine the game from different angles as we continue along the road less travelled. It's been a couple of weeks since our last episode, but as always, there's plenty to stimulate the grey matter, from happenings in the elite amateur and professional arenas to thought-provoking ideas about the game bobbing up on social media. Alongside me today, to see where this rudderless ship might end up, is co-captain from the start, Adrian Logue. Now, I know that you've got an interesting tidbit to share with us in a moment about champagne-induced industry injuries, and that's going to be a hell of a way to start the show.
Okay. Do you want me to share that now?
No, I do not want you to share it now. We've thrown out the hook. We've got the listeners in.
All right.
That's where we're going to start. Champagne-induced injuries. What have you been watching and listening to and talking about with golf this week? Anything?
And a little bit of, I guess, you know, no, not much.
It's a funny time of year,
isn't
it? Yeah, it's a funny time of year.
Yeah.
Beaming in via the magic of the internet from Thailand, where he's made his way to the Women's Amateur Asia Pacific after covering last week's Asia Pacific Amateur Championship. No doubt enjoying a couple of weeks on the ground. Jimmy Emanuel, Golf Australia Magazine Deputy Editor. It must be nice to be out there covering some tournament golf. Jimmy, in luxury last week, no doubt, with Augusta National footing the bills.
It is nice to be back covering golf tournaments, but it was actually more luxurious this week, hotel-wise, than last week.
Is that right?
It was interesting last week, to say the least. And then this week, it's 5-star on the beach at Pattaya. So, yeah, probably golf course better last week, but hotel better this week. So, yeah, win some, you lose some.
You'll be back here soon, and it'll be a dose of reality. So, don't get used to any of it, my friend. You'll be back in the studio. Looking forward to catching up on what happened and unfolded last week and what we're expecting this week. Now, before we come to any of that, though, Logue, tell us not only about champagne-induced injuries, but tell us why you were down that rabbit hole.
Oh, wasn't much of a rabbit hole, but much to my amusement, Dustin Johnson was trying to fumble open a bottle of champagne after he won
$37 million or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, with the now customary champagne celebration that they do after winning a LIV tournament. And
that's eight times? That's the eighth time it's happened?
Yes, that's right. Tradition. Yeah, it's a tradition.
It's a tradition like no other.
Yeah. Did you see this, Jimmy? Stupidly, yeah. He's done the rookie move of bending over the champagne bottle and trying to take the foil off the top of the champagne. It's you've got to treat it like a live snake.
Absolutely.
And
it's like a loaded gun. You don't ever point it at anyone or anything, especially yourself.
And anyway,
you never look a bottle of champagne in the eye.
That's right. Anyway, it's come up and smashed him in the face in a most undignified manner. Mm-hmm. But I immediately thought to Google how many people die from champagne corks. So he's dodged a literal champagne
is it more
cork
than zero?
Bullet here.
Is it more than zero?
What would you guess? How many people die from champagne cork injuries per year?
See, so now you've said that, I've got to think, maybe it's 500. I don't know. I'm going to say 10.
Jimmy?
I'm guessing close to 100.
Oh, okay. 24. Which is a shocking large number. 24 people die from champagne cork-related injuries.
And that has to be a bad time to die, because you're not popping champagne for any other reason than there's just been some sort of a happy occasion.
Well, no, that's right.
No, that's not true. They could work in a cork factory and they could be, champagne cork-related death, but it's not by champagne cork.
Isn't there a cork shortage? Isn't there a cork issue?
There's a urethane shortage, I know that.
Wine bottles, you can't buy the that's why you get screw-on lids on most of your wine bottles these days.
No, I think that's mostly because they keep the wine better.
Is it?
Yeah.
And it's easier.
Yeah. I get all that, but my understanding was it was a cork. Anyway, so there you go. So Dustin
maybe a shortage of quality cork.
Yes, perhaps. Yes. Perhaps.
But yeah, he copped in the face. It actually,
24 people.
24.
Every year, 24 people. That's extraordinary that could happen. Every year, 24 people.
I think it's an average.
I'm never going to open a bottle of champagne the same. I'm going to think, am I number 24 for the year?
That implies the injuries are much, much more than that. Like, that'd be in the tens of thousands. There's, this is just off the top of my head. But
you can see the algorithm ticking over in his mind here, yeah.
There's 18,000 people injured every year from TV sets falling on them.
What?
And 40 deaths from TV sets falling on people. Now, that's mostly children, which...
That's the good news.
You have had a really thrilling week with me.
Here's the thing about that, though. That has to be a fairly modern phenomenon, because a TV falling on someone suggests it's been hung on a wall. And how long have we been doing that for? TVs on the wall, realistically, in residential homes. 15 years, yeah, 20
not
years?
Not that long.
But it's not that long, is it? Flat screen TVs.
A kid could pull a TV off a TV stand.
No, yeah, true. Or like the big old ones on their own legs. If you were a kid and jumped up on that, that could come down.
A kid could pull one of those over. They weighed about 3 tonne. You had to bring them in on a forklift.
That makes them more deadly.
That's why they kill.
Yeah, that's why you cut kids. There you go. What else? Anything else? Any other?
No, but I'll come back with more.
Golf cart injuries
and death-related statistics next week.
I want to start.
While we're on champagne spraying at golf tournaments, mm-hmm. I was aside the 18th green at the Asia Pacific Amateur when Harrison Crowe won, and the Australian team were trying to get some champagne to spray it. And I was standing there with our good friend John Huggan, who then noticed that they couldn't get champagne, so they grabbed water bottles. And there is not a person who hates something more than Huggy people spray people with water when they win a golf tournament. Just the disdain that he watched it unfold with was just, it was magic to be there.
He hates it almost as much as he hates air hugs.
That's right. The whole location. All tight. Huggy does disdain. He specializes in disdain, in fairness. That's his thing, Huggy.
He tells a great story. I'm sure it was Dan Jenkins when they bumped into each other at the start of a week at a golf tournament, and Dan said to Huggy, "So what's upsetting you this week?"
It's a fantastic start. I want to go to last week, Jimmy. I want to start there. So we know who won. Harrison Crowe won. We'll talk about that in a minute. And there's some interesting stuff to think about there. He's going to delay turning professional because he gets an invite to the Masters and the Open, et cetera, et cetera. But what was it like on the ground? We know who won. I wrote a piece about it's about much more than the people who win, obviously. And that's not a new piece. And plenty of people have written it before. Plenty of people wrote it last week. But what's the reality of that on the ground? You did a story on a couple of young guys, or one of the young guys from Lebanon. There's people from far-flung places of the world taking part in this Asia-Pacific Amateur, isn't there? It's a really interesting tournament.
I mean, that's the special part about it, particularly early in the week. Again, Huggy and I would sit down and go through the list of players and sort of divide up the interesting stories between us about, what are you going to chase? And there's no shortage. You know, we could have done 10 stories a day to go through and find, you know, that different angle. And Huggy did a couple of great ones, one on a guy from Kyrgyzstan, that's right, who made the cut, first player
from Kyrgyzstan to make the cut. It's a pretty impressive performance,
yeah,
actually.
Which is a really impressive thing. So that's a those stories are the impressive, important part, because we just had Martin Slumbers in the press conference here, and he said, sleepy. Even for him, that's the exciting part, sleepy.
You're not going to make sleepy
apparently
a
that's
thing.
Not it.
You don't think so?
No.
Okay.
Stop trying to make sleepy a thing.
I did ask a friend at the RNA if that was his nickname, and I was told very sternly that, no, that's not the case. But he was talking about the excitement is watching the players try and make the cut rather, you know, until we get to the try and the win. And that's the special part, because you get to watch these people who have never played anything like a tournament of this standard, and they're excited to be alongside other amateurs, but amateurs who they know. And you turn a corner and you meet a player from somewhere that has one, you know, Lebanon. I spoke to the two guys from Lebanon. Lebanon's got one golf course.
Of course, yeah.
And there was countless countries that had one or two golf courses or just sand greens. And it was that's the magic of the week, really.
I'm just going to turn the video off here, Jimmy, because the Zoom is not playing ball with us, so we'll just see if we can devote all of the audio to the – all of the bandwidth to the audio. The bit that I wrote about, and I don't want to just make this bit because I wrote about it, but I think what's interesting about it is the long-term investment that Augusta National and the RNA have made in the game. So the Asia-Pacific Amateur – well, let's take a step back. Most of these kinds of tournaments, they start and they disappear very quickly because they're not an instant success and produce something amazing. Yeah. What they've done here is really invest in something long-term, and they're starting to see the fruits of that, I think. Hideki won the Asia-Pacific Amateur. Now he's won the Masters. You had the young man from Nepal and the young guy from Kyrgyzstan made the cut this week. This is the slow turning wheels. This is genuine change, Lowe, yeah, not just box-ticking change.
Yeah, and it shows why you need governing bodies that are like benevolent in these sort of matters, right, where they're not completely dictated by making every little thing they do profitable.
Yeah.
So sometimes they have to actually invest in the game because they're, you know, they're earning money from one part of the game and reinvesting it in another part of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And full marks to both the RNA and Augusta National. I'm critical of Augusta National and the RNA in all sorts of areas, but in this area, credit where it's due, they do something terrific. We'll talk about the Asia, the women's event that you're at this week in a minute, Jimmy. But, of course, Harrison Crowe, we have to, being Australians. Harrison Crowe won the New South Wales Open earlier this year. Am I to understand, Jimmy, that what Harrison Crowe really needs to do is get you on staff every time you attend a tournament he's playing, he wins? Is that the fact of the matter?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. I was at the New South Wales Open covering that, and he won it. And then I show up here, and he wins this when he said he'd been playing bad all through America and Europe. So, yeah, clearly I need to be a paid employee of the Crowe family. I have put it to his dad and his mum that I will accept Rocky Road and Brownie from his mum, Shauna, who makes the world
sensational
best, Rocky Road and Brownie.
Yeah, very, very good. There's something magical about them, in fact. No, that sounded
completely that came out wrong.
No, that's...
They're nice.
I absolutely did not mean that. They're very good brownies and Rocky Road.
They taste nice.
They're very good.
Which is good. Tell us a bit about Harrison. I know not much about him. I know he won the New South Wales Open earlier this year, obviously, but you'd obviously know him a bit, or you've seen him certainly playing up close now a few times, Jimmy. The only thing I really know about Harrison, and I think he turned up on the Project TV here on Channel 10 during the week, was the hitting of the golf shot over the hotel or wherever it was in St Andrews, which in a lot of golf circles wouldn't have gone down particularly well, I can't imagine. What's he like, Jimmy?
Yeah, I don't think that did go down particularly well with the governing bodies of Australia who were looking after him that week. But he's a great guy. He's young and still learning and all that sort of stuff. But he's a really solid player. I mean, he just sort of gets the job done. He's a really good putter. Swings the golf club really well, coached by John Sirhan and member at St. Michael's. And there's not a part of his game that I've seen that is weak. And admittedly, I've watched him win two golf tournaments.
So you've kind of seen the best of it, haven't you? Yeah.
Yeah, but he grew up at Bardwell Valley. He lives just over the other side of the fence. He's worked there.
Lester Peterson territory.
Yeah, exactly. And he spent all of COVID basically going down to the club, getting in a cart and playing golf all day. Doesn't like to hit balls that much. So he would play the course again and again and again and again and learnt to play when he wasn't at his best golf swing-wise and that sort of stuff. It was interesting that he won last week. He's as Logue knows, he's a real chatty guy on the golf course. So when he won that New South Wales Open, he had this swarm of mates following him on unroad fairways, and he was talking around and chatting to them and having a great time. There wasn't many crowds there last week, and he was playing often with, you know, people who don't have English as their first language. So he was looking for people to talk with, the coaches there and his dad and his dad's mate Dipper, who were on site. And he's just a nice young guy and a really impressive player. He spent some time with Adam Scott the week before he won. He missed a cut at the Japan Open, and Scotty told him, just go get ready and win. So he did that. And the other bit of insight I've got is he does not a bad rendition of Country Road by John Denver on a karaoke mic at, you know, 12:30 on a
Is there any
Sunday
other type
evening.
Of rendition of Country Road than Ben?
Well, no, I must say there is – I've got to find out his name. One of the guys on the New Zealand team last week who ran the karaoke on the Sunday night was the most impressive entertainer I've ever seen. Like he could sing everything. He knew the words to everything. He was unreal. So, yeah, he's got a career if golf doesn't work out for him. Harrison, not so much.
Do we know or do we want to know the origins of Dipper?
I didn't ask because it's a great nickname.
It's a like, great nickname.
When you're writing a story and you get delivered Dipper, you don't ask.
There'll be a story behind that that's probably not fit for print. Interesting time in a player's career, Logue. We see this. Some people achieve, like Harrison has, two amazing things, and are never heard of again. Yep. Some achieve a couple of things like Harrison and go on to become the superstars of the game. And you really can't tell, can you? The swing, Jimmy said, the swing, they can't really see much physically about the game. There's any sort of weakness. That's true of all the players, isn't it? So what's the separator? What dictates whether we keep hearing about Harrison Crowe or whether he goes on to be like so many others?
We get so many, don't we, that come through. Curtis Luck had, you know, dominant win in this thing and looked for all the world like he was going to just take on the world. And Harrison Crowe, his game looks very good, like Jimmy was mentioning. He's got a very simple-looking approach to golf. He doesn't look very technical. He doesn't seem like a swing guy.
No, not at all.
Yeah, he's just like a look-and-hit-it guy, and I quite like that about him. And, he, you know, like you said, he can turn off and turn on during the course of a round and seems to, like, switch on in the right way. So I was really impressed with his on-course demeanour at the New South Wales Open. And the off-course stuff might be a bit of a distraction for him. He might have to watch that. Like, he obviously likes a bit of a party. But, you know, he's young, so 20 years old.
There's a danger in not doing you, though, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. And maybe that's the right mix of stuff for him. We'll see. I don't know. We'll watch with interest. He's staying amateur, he says.
Mm-hmm.
And why not now? There's a pretty big carrot to stay amateur with entry into the Open and the Masters. So you'd presume he'll definitely wait at least till the Masters.
Well, normally...
Yeah, well, that...
You would have said that, Jimmy. I know you said it. But what if Greg Norman comes and waves a huge check in his face to join LIV? So this is we've never had this before, have we? This notion that there might be some alternative. We've already seen a couple of amateurs go straight to LIV, turn professional, never playing a tour event of any other tour in the world. And they're players like Harrison. They're the players that LIV has sort of targeted as something exciting. There's a bit of news about them. That might change for the second and the third year.
He would feel indestructible about his chances as a professional going forward, I think, which means, you know, he's going to make it and he's going to make it.
So is that a barometer of the importance of the majors and where they still stand versus LIV? And in that whole other discussion about that, it's players of Harrison's generation who are really going to tell us who holds what in what regard. I'm a believer that there could be generational change about that. The majors could lose their luster. That could happen. But it'll take time.
Yeah.
So,
He was ready to turn pro. He was going to turn pro the next day if he didn't win that golf tournament. Yeah. Because via his New South Wales Open win, he's going to get a lot of starts and he could chase a European Tour card via the PGA Tour of Australasia. Now, he's not turning pro until that last putty hits on Sunday, hopefully, at the Open, and that'll do him and he'll walk away. But, look, I mean, he will get some attention. We discussed it last week because... young TK from Thailand, who's 15 and won on the Asian tour, he's already got a LIV logo on his sleeve. So he's covered in more sponsors than a NASCAR car, but he's got a LIV logo on his sleeve, but he's only played one event. So we were discussing, well, if he wins, he's going to be given exemptions to two majors, namely Augusta National first, who haven't commented on LIV players. And they're not going to turn down their own invitation from their own event to come and play the Masters, are they? So it was going to put the wheels in motion to get a decision on what's going to happen with those players, because he might still be an amateur, but you don't put a logo on your shirt if you're that sort of high profile an amateur unless there's some sort of thing attached to it. But again, interestingly, TK plans on finishing school and wants to go play college golf in America. So he's years away from being a full-time LIV prospect. So do they start, for what lack of a better term, pre-buying? Do you sort of, you know, contract someone in? And, you know, I think Harrison will get a bit of attention, but I think that's not quite as high up as what they'll be chasing for next year.
If you were Harrison Crowe's dad and this decision was this came, or even TK, let's say TK's family and the people who advise him, he's 15 years old. And I'm the greatest believer in the Masters and the Open and love the notion of the specialness of all of that. Here's the reality. Professional golf has no guarantees. And it would be wonderful to play at Augusta and the Open. But if someone offered you, let's pick a number, $1 million, and all you had to do was not play those two, that's the only cost of that, you could not in all good conscience as a responsible adult say you shouldn't do that.
That's where I think Harrison's probably thinking his career prospects are pretty indestructible at the moment without LIV. Mm. Like the traditional way, he'd be super confident about his ability to make it right at the moment with the results that he's put in. And every time these few times he's measured himself against professionals, he's come out pretty good, winning a professional tournament and winning this event with, you know, many of the top amateurs in the world. One interesting thing which Mike Clayton said on the No Laying Up podcast, which is a very good Mike Clayton podcast, by the way, it was one of Mike Clayton's best performances, I think.
No Laying Up really need our help to get the listeners on board, so go and have a listen to No Laying Up.
So he mentions a point that he's made probably on our podcast before, that the equipment these days allows every young bloke, when they learn how to play the way that the equipment demands, to hit it really long, hit your wedges close and putt well. When that, when they play in that manner, they can shoot super low. And the point he's making is that that allows a lot of young blokes to think they can make it as a pro. And there's, you know, so there's now, you've now got thousands of young blokes knocking the door down to see if they can become a pro, whereas, what used to be the case with the old equipment was you would get found out a lot sooner and you'd go get a normal, like a quote-unquote normal job. Do we think that's the case with Harrison Crowe? Because we've seen prospects come from Australia who've gone and turned pro very quickly from decent amateur careers. And
yeah, not just Australia. Ty Tryon won the PGA Tour Q School at the age of 17.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've been... Not much.
The results give them every indication that they could probably go on and do it. And there's a lot of other factors that come into play once you abandon amateur golf. Of course, you're sort of, you know, on your own.
That's right. It's kind of one of the things that LIV has done. This is what it'll change. And I think this is an unforeseen consequence of LIV. It's not one of the biggest things, but this is an unforeseen consequence. It's now part of this discussion and thinking for somebody like Harrison Crowe and other elite amateurs around the place. But there's a possibility you could get this sort of LIV thing. Golf used to be exactly what you say, no guarantees. In fact, right up to the very, very, very elite level where there was no guarantee every year that you'd be back next year. You could lose your card at any given year. You could lose your swing. You have an injury. Something happens. It could all be over. What LIV seems to have done and what I think it will do eventually is actually change golf from that catch, you know, eat what you kill mentality that professional golf has always prided itself on into a – contracted game, more like a league, more like other professional sports, where there's a guaranteed income.
That's, I don't mind that.
I don't know whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but it is a fundamental change about golf that is makes it completely different to what it has always been.
As long as it's not the entirety of professional golf, like I think you still want to have the majors be that meritocracy and ultimate test of skill. But if the rest of it is just lean into the fact that it's an entertainment product, then the logical thing is to pick the, you know, pick an entertaining bunch of players and create storylines around it and make it a league and have intrigue in the off season. And
I think I agree intellectually, but something about it doesn't feel right when you've grown up with golf not being that, if that makes sense.
It's not going to be 100% that. You're still going to have national opens and majors.
I don't think that's the way it completely goes, to be honest. So yeah. I think it's maybe part of it. Like Logue says, there's going to be elements of it that are more purely entertainment, and then there's more classic, to use a word, tournament golf. There is, you know, are two things that come with this in the realm of it being the AAC discussion with Harrison. He would feel pretty bulletproof at the moment, but it's been a bit of a poison chalice for Australian golfers who've won it, because Antonio Madarka and Curtis Lucker, the two, have won it, and neither one of them's up there at the moment. And there's actually a good example of, you take the money and you don't get to play the Masters. Colt Knost was there as an on-course commentator last year. When he won the USAM and the US Pub Links, he turned down his invitation to Augusta, and he was of the opinion, well, I'll get there anyway, I'm good enough, and he never played a Masters. So, I mean, he made couple of million bucks playing the PGA Tour. You could ask him, say, do you think that's worth it? You know, are you happy with that decision? Because you probably would have made some money as a pro anyway. So I think balancing those things is a never 100% thing. But I think the wait now for someone like Harrison is a smart move. By actually forcing him to stay amateur, by the time he turns pro in the middle to end of next year, there might actually be a bit more clarity around what his options are. Because right now, if you take one option, not the other, you're probably ruling yourself out from the other one for a period of time. If down the road it gets a bit friendlier, or if there's a bit more allowance, there might be a chance to take advantage of everything that's out there.
But isn't this the age-old question? Is there anything left to be gained by remaining amateur? Can you, in fact, damage a golf game that's heading on a certain trajectory by staying amateur, when actually the sensible thing to do is to turn professional and go and start learning the craft of professional golf? I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer, but that's the risk you take, is it not?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, Augusta National and the Masters has a big amateur link with Bobby Jones, et cetera, that's why they kind of – they let a lot of amateurs in via these tournaments, which is a great thing for that club and that tournament to do. you'd almost like to see. Everyone knows that every player who's going to be a chance of winning the Asia Pacific Amateur Championship is going to turn professional, particularly if they win. So surely we're at a stage where we can accept that and say, you've won, you've got your exemption for next year. Even if you turn pro, you're welcome to come and play. Now, sure, it might then say, well, we don't have just the best of the best pros, but he earned his place. So why does it matter if he's going to take a check or if he's not?
Like, how would you feel about that if you're a PGA Tour player who's not playing the Masters and somebody who's also now a fellow professional wins the Asia Pacific Amateur, nowhere near as competitive as any PGA Tour event, and they've got the easy run in? I think there's issues. I take your point, but I think there's issues with that as a notion, fundamentally. But
I think that's in the world we're in now of LIV and PGA Tour and all that sort of stuff. There's going to be issues from players somewhere about something on everything. Mm. So
that always has been in fairness.
I think maybe to a point, and you don't disregard it completely, but the way other players feel about someone else getting something, that can't be a major. That's a concern for the tour. The tour is the players' organisation. The Masters and Augusta National does not belong to the tour. That does not belong to the players. They're invited to play. So they are in a position to set their own rules, which the way the world ranking situation is going, they may well do it again and just throw out the idea that world rankings, because, you know, how will some other players feel about, you know, the 50th ranked player in the world at April 1 next year gets into the Masters? And I dare say they weren't necessarily going to be there if there was all the other people who were ranked previous to PGA Tour bans, etc. So,
if you're ranked 51 in the world and the kid that wins the Asia-Pacific Amateur turns pro and gets a start in the Masters and you don't, I think you've got a legitimate case to be not particularly happy with that. Having said that, there's always going to be issues no matter what you do. But I think the world rankings are dead.
The simple answer to that is the one that's been around in pro golf forever. Play better.
Mm. Yeah.
You play better, that you get what you deserve. You know, that's the idea of professional golf is.
And also, if you miss out 1 year, what sort of confidence do you have about your career if you think to yourself, wow, that was my one and only chance? Like, you know, if you're a professional golfer, you've got to back yourself to be getting there. If you're good enough, you're going to make it.
You've got a right to be upset if you miss out by the most tiny of margins, sure. But as Logue says, I mean, if you sit there, you know, steaming about that and about someone else being in there, you probably don't have the mindset to be having success at the highest level.
I'm not sure I suggested steaming. I was just suggesting that maybe that would be a legitimate thing to be not overly happy about, that somebody who's beaten a field that's not even close to the fields that you play in Asia. There is not a kid in that Asia-Pacific amateur field last week who is close to a top 50 player in the world. And they're good. Nobody's saying they're not good. But none of them are close to being a top 50 player in the world. So, and that's the whole point of that. You need to stay amateur so that you don't sort of take a spot, I think. So, look, it's interesting stuff. But you can feel it. And that's got nothing to do with LIV, really, has it? I mean, it's in some sort of ways. It's just there's these seismic shifts are happening in professional golf. And it's sort of interesting. What impact does that have on the product? What impact does the product changing have on professional golf's role more broadly in the game and how it attracts people to the game and how it represents the game? All of those things are going to change on the back of that as well, the relationship that golf has with non-golf and all of those other sorts of things as well. So,
yeah, it's in a state of almost crisis at the moment.
I can't remember anything like this.
The Collins Dictionary Word of the Year is permacrisis.
Really?
Yes.
Did they make that up? Is that a word?
I've never heard it.
Has that been a word before?
How is that word? Have you ever heard anybody say permacrisis? This is the first time we've ever heard it. Apparently, that's the Collins Dictionary Word of the Year now. But that's
why they're not the Oxford.
There you go. We're in a state of permacrisis.
State of permacrisis. Interesting. Interesting idea. Anyway, look, well done, Harrison. A phenomenal win. And in fact, we haven't talked about it enough. What a way to win, Jimmy. Faltered on the front nine, gave up a lead, coughed it up, but just ripped up the back nine and won the tournament. Flat out just went out and won it. It was an impressive performance.
He did. I mean, he and Bo Jin of China, they really displayed the differences in them really play golf at a high level. Harrison looked like he was chasing the win and he wanted to be there. Bo Jin looked like he did not want to be there. He went to water on that back nine. He really didn't look like he was up for the fight. And Harrison almost threw it away at 18. He hit a pull second shot that he said, I accidentally flushed it and it had to go in the water and it sat down and then he hit a good chip and then had a fourth that would have been the most nervous in his life. But he was composed and did it all. Very impressive way to do it. And did it with a local caddy in one of my favourite outfits of all time, all lime green, bucket hat.
They were great, weren't they? Those outfits, they would have made a great Halloween costume, I thought. Did you get your hands on?
The most disappointing thing of this trip so far is that I was determined to get one of those bucket hats.
Yeah.
And I'd mentioned it to a few people in the media centre and I thought I could go and just offer some cash to a caddy, but I didn't want to get a caddy in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So then at drinks on the Sunday night, we're talking about it and a couple of the people from Augusta said, oh, yeah, we got hats. We went and asked the caddy shed and they gave us a used caddy hat. So,
you might have just got them
shattered,
fired from Augusta National. The membership's void.
Oh, I don't think so. Nah, I think that'll be all right.
Okay. All right. We'll see.
It was a couple of the workers from Augusta were there covering the event and got a hat. Then this week at the women's event at Siam Country Club, we've got another quality outfit. We've got I'm trying to remember the color action. I think it's a blue pant and then a yellow waistcoat style jacket and then a straw hat tied up in a white sort of fabric number.
I can see you in that, Jimmy.
An eclectic ensemble.
Yeah, I can see you in that. That could work for you. Let's talk about this week's event, the Asia. I want to talk about women's golf more generally. There's some interesting things happening, not the least of them being this week's tournament, which we'll get some words on from you in a moment. But like Ewan Porter posted a really interesting little video this morning. He's commentating at the LPGA event in Japan. They co-sanctioned an event they have done for a long time. 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning, Hinako Shibuno heading to the first tee, could not see the golf course for the crowds. Now, you don't have to go far to find people to tell you that women's golf isn't entertaining, it's not interesting. Part of the reason that it doesn't attract as much sponsorship and money as the men's game is because nobody's interested in watching it. Japan and Korea and South Korea tell us that's not true, don't they? You see scenes like that in South Korea and Japan all the time. What do we make of that? Anything? Am I making too much of that, or is that...
No, I mean, it's not surprising. It is very entertaining product, and I enjoy watching it. We heard news today as well, or a couple of days ago, that Chicago Golf Club is going to host the US Women's Open as well. It might be like 10 years from now or something, but it just continues that trend of seeing really good golf, these really good golf swings and interesting personalities on some of the best golf courses in the world, and that's a formula that we don't have in men's golf.
And without that final part, the courses, that's the biggest change to me in women's golf, and it's the most important, is taking those big events to those really storied golf courses is a game changer in credibility and prestige, but in the product itself, the golf
I think that's
seen.
What brings people, because for the majors, that's when you've got more attention on the game than any other time. And when they see an incredible venue, like Chicago Golf Club will be an amazing venue, that brings new viewers to the game and they see something that's interesting and catches their interest and then off you go. You can have this Toto Japan Classic is not at a particularly good golf course. Where
Sita course at the – I can't remember the name of the golf club.
I did do the preview.
It's a long time ago.
Not a particularly interesting golf course, but it's probably like a golf course shaped golf course.
if a child drew a dog.
But it's going to have the same interest because of the storylines and they get to know the personalities and Shinako Hibuno. There's nothing like her in the men's game.
No, she's amazing. She's fantastic.
Yeah, that's not surprising at all.
Jimmy, what do you reckon? Women's golf, we always carry on saying it doesn't get the credit it deserves and all that's true, but the notion that, that just people can't possibly be as interested in it as the men's game, and I just every time I think of Japan and South Korea and the women's tours there, it's like that is clearly just not true. There's proof that it's not true.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's not true. I mean, that mention of Chicago Golf Club, if you get a chance, have a look at the future venues for the US Women's Open. Yeah. It is Pebble Beach, good. Compared to where the men will play, it's incredible how good that run is. But, it's covering men's and women's events is exceptionally different. But I love covering women's golf tournaments. The players are so much more engaging and willing to have a bit of fun. They do a lot more of the social stuff for the tour or whoever's hosting. And their talks to you after their round are full of a bit more color and they're willing to have more fun. And watching the ball striking and everything that goes on here is so impressive. So it doesn't get the attention it deserves outside of probably Asia. And it's to golf fans' detriment to not go and watch more women's golf in person because I think I've mentioned it before. I think I've written it in a column. My most hated thing in golf is, and I used to get a lot when working the pro shop particularly, is a guy comes in who couldn't hit the side of a barn and he tells you he watches the women's golf because it's more relatable. it is the least relatable thing in the world. Like, there's no fairways and greens being missed. I've covered Grace Kim playing tournament golf for quite a while now. I honestly can tell you I've never seen Grace miss a fairway. And she doesn't hit it nowhere. It's got speed on it too. Like, that is something that is not relatable to any golfer apart from Grace Kim. Like, that's just... It's a ridiculous statement. And sometimes they'll tell you the distances. You know, the distances a lot of these women hit it out here is crazy far compared to what you would think as well.
Oh, no, yeah, no question about that. I completely agree with you about the relatable thing. And I always go back to Bonville, which many people in Australia and certainly on the East Coast have played. Bonville's a very popular resort, north coast of New South Wales. Steph Kiriakou won there with a score of, I think from memory, about 17 under, shot 9 under, I think, on the second day from essentially the tees that you play when you go and stay there as a resort guest. I played Bonville a bunch of times with some pretty handy players too. Nobody's come close to sniffing a score like that. There is nothing relatable about that game that they play at that level.
I think Minji Lee, and not that beating men needs to be the measure of women's golf. It never has to be that. But Minji Lee, I think, had at some point last year had the best strokes, the best proximity to the hole from 150 metres in several distances from 150 metres in of all golf, yep. Not just women's golf, all professional golf. Minji Lee was like topping that category.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, so
I think a lot of people who try and talk about women's golf and they have this, and I don't know where it comes from, this assumption that it's because they hole putts everywhere. Like, the ball striking is the most impressive part, and it's with longer clubs. It's not going in with wedges. They're playing golf courses as they were intended, and I must say the Australian Opens is going to be a great chance to see that. I mean, Mike Clayton's written a great piece about Sandbelt golf for the upcoming December issue of Golf Australia magazine, and talks about how good it will be to watch them play those golf courses. I mean, Hannah Green and Minji Lee playing those golf courses the way they're supposed to be, let alone the other major champions playing the women's event, is going to be fascinating. The guys will be taking lines off some of those tees that'll give Clates a heart attack, but the women will play that thing brilliantly, and it's so much more exciting to watch in person. I think it maybe gets lost on the TV a little bit. And we don't have as many events at home in Australia, so there's less opportunity.
The TV thing's true of all golf, isn't it? I think the same as men's golf. When you go out and watch men's golf, it's nothing like what you see on the TV. It's like, this is amazing on the TV. It just looks like a parade of people hitting good shots. But when you go live, it's completely different. I think they both suffer from that, in fairness.
I was joking this morning with one of the Australian people here when Kelsey Bennett and one of the Japanese players hit these stunning shots into their last hole, which is the ninth. The Japanese player hit it off a downslope in the rough where it was like, you know, sitting down and below her feet, and managed this thing that ran past the pin and no one clapped, no one did anything. And Kelsey Bennett, you know, stuffed it in there real close and nothing. And it's that attitude of, I think people go to golf tournaments having watched golf on TV and aren't they supposed to do that? Aren't they supposed to hit the fairway, and then aren't they supposed to hit it at the hole? And like, when you go to a golf, you see bad shots, you hear the difference in shots, and it's incomparable. And I think women's golf, it suffers more from the TV experience than men's golf because there's probably less, maybe sometimes, description of what's going on, but also the quality is wider spread. So when you get out and watch the tournament, you can actually see that quality on display. And there's more different swings. There's more interest in it, to be honest.
As is the quality of the coverage. Less cameras. Everything's less about women's golf. There's less of everything. There's less time devoted to the production. There's less time devoted to telling the players' stories. And Meg McLaren's talked about this plenty of times.
Yeah.
If they just swap the LPGA with the PGA Tour coverage, there'd be a huge change in the way women's golf was viewed just from the amount of coverage that they get and the way that it's done. So some interesting stuff.
Have you, Jimmy, just to the field for this week, have you had a chance to look at Saki Baba the Japanese who won the US Women's Amateur. Looks a great prospect.
Briefly, she was actually in the media centre yesterday, and I had a brief watch of her play a couple of holes earlier in the week, but I plan to get out and watch a lot more. She's big, tall, sort of she herself described her as having a similar body and swing to Nelly Korda, and as of yet, I haven't been able to fault that. So it's very impressive. I mean, she's actually world number three at this point, so a big favourite to win a tournament like this, and very impressive. She's out there this afternoon with Kirsten Rudgley. So,
who might well be her nearest competitor in this event, along with Kelsey Bennett. Some genuine Australian chances.
Yeah, I mean, Kelsey Bennett's in a Harrison Crowe situation. She'll go to ladies European to a school in December. So if she doesn't win, she'll turn pro. But there's two major starts also this week, but there's also an Augusta National Women's Amateur starter. I don't know Kelsey's convinced that she would stay amateur for those, whether she's ready to go. But she and Kirsten are two of the favourites here. Kelsey was the runner-up last year, and Kirsten is, you know, one of the more impressive players in amateur golf. She spent a lot of time playing pro events last summer and, you know, didn't look out of place at all. So there's a couple of Thai players as well that I won't even attempt to pronounce their names, who are very promising as well, that would be worth, you know, if you had a chance to watching them. And, defending champions here this week as well, which doesn't happen in amateur golf ever because they win something and they turn pro, basically. So it's these events, I think, Saki Bubba obviously stands out on the page to everyone because she's won the US Women's Amateur, but there's so many good players that you don't necessarily have that much experience with that you kind of turn a corner and who's that? And you get a bit of an experience for it. And, you know, there's even Janeth Wong, who lives in Australia but plays for Malaysia. I mean, she's won 5 club championships at Metro, won a crazy amount of time. She was 3rd in the Southeast Asia Games. And, you know, she's here this week and wouldn't be asked to do any press unless she shot 65 because there's not necessarily that wider spread of knowledge because there's so many good players.
The challenge for her might be that after 5 club championships at Metro, she's probably not missed a fairway in all of those years and hasn't had to hit off a bad lie.
Hasn't had a bad lie
years.
Since she was 12.
She's going to be horrified what happens. Right.
On a more serious note, though, Jimmy, there's something to be said for winning, isn't there? That everything that comes with winning, no matter what level it's at, is really important the next time you have a chance to win at the next level up. We've seen loads and loads and loads of really, really, really good players who just never seem to find that knack of winning. Then you look at somebody like Tiger, who just – he more than had a knack, he had a gift for being able to win, which is different to playing good golf and all of those other things. It's its own skill, is it not?
Well, I think that's exactly right. If you don't win and win regularly at a certain level – I don't know what there is to suggest that you'll have success at the next level up. Because in golf, by going from the amateur ranks to, or going from junior to open amateur events, going to professional golf, you're going step levels up. So you need to be winning something and probably more than once. And that Bo Jin last week's a good example. I mean, he hasn't won anything big. He's a really, really good player. He hasn't won anything big. So if he's turning pro, he have some questions in his mind about, because, you know, professional golf's about winning. You can now make a good career out of, you know, being Charles Howell the 3rd and just top 10-ing half your life and end up with, you know, millions in the bank and winning once or twice. But
he got a live start, didn't he?
He did. So yeah, I think winning is a crucial thing. And even if you're a Kelsey Bennett this week, and regardless of the result, you plan on turning pro, that win is important because it's even important to help get sponsors, to get, you know, exposure, all those sorts of things, because that's all part of the game now too. You know, it's not just about playing golf, which is, not lost on any of the players in these fields. They all know that there's extras they've got to do.
Yeah, if you're not one of those ones that are like going for the win, you're going to be like one of those players who complains about being 51st in the world rankings and doesn't make it into the Masters field, probably. You
know, what an oversimplification of a nuanced, sophisticated argument that I was making. Regardless.
A podcast host who complains about promoting other podcasts on his podcast.
I wasn't complaining about it at all. I was merely stating the fact that no-laying up does not need our help to add to their listeners. Something interesting that I thought happened this week, Logue, Atiyah Titikon, the Thai lash. I think she's only still 19. I've heard it plenty of times on the coverage. I saw her play out here a couple of years ago in Dubbo, actually, at the New South Wales Women's Open, and was just
you were very impressed. Weren't
you? I was beyond impressed. It was amazing. First
winner of the Women's Asia. That's
exactly right.
Ascended, which has also produced two major winners.
Ascended to world number one this week. Now, she has, I've been trying to say this for about 3 years, she's just flown completely under the radar into the top-ranked spot in the world. How does that happen? Does that tell us anything about the game and personalities and coverage and all those other things? How does that happen?
Well, it's not under the radar for followers of the women's game, is it? She's been impressive for a few years now. Yeah. She was Rookie of the Year in the LET 2 years ago, I think, and then... But did she win Rookie of the Year on the LPGA this year as well?
She's going to be the Rookie of the Year this year, and she very well could be Player of the Year as well.
Right.
If she's not, something's very wrong with the way they're calculating stuff. Well, if she's the world number one and isn't Rookie of the Year, something's gone wrong.
But what a powerhouse.
They do use a point system, so I think there's a good chance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what a powerhouse Thai women golfers are. Oh,
very much.
And inspiring, you know, another group of Thai women golfers playing this week as well. I'm sure that's been a storyline.
We spoke to a few of the Thai players earlier in the week, and they all know a Thai. I mean, that's the unique thing about the number one in the world being 19 years old. The people playing this amateur event know her. They've played golf with her. They've been on Thai
went to school with her.
And, yeah, exactly. So we've said, you know, do you know a Thai? And they said, yeah, absolutely. I played a lot of golf. She's great, and we message all the time, and that shows the unbelievable rise and how impressive that is.
On the back of the Jatanagans as well, who are superstars over there. They had a movie made, a biopic.
Yeah, never going to live that down, and rightly so, but I'm never going to live it down, yes.
They had a biopic made of them, and Paddy Tavitanikas.
Need the inflection at the end. It's bad enough without the inflection at the end. Come on.
And Paddy Tavitanikas as well, who's a sensational player.
She's won a major.
Yeah, won the ANA, or the Chevron, as it's called now. So, that's an amazing little batch of players coming through there. It's...
Like the players they've got in the field this week is very impressive. There was I want to say two who were equal runner up last year, and just you know there's talent everywhere, and I mean there's golf everywhere in Thailand. There's Siam Country Club with 99 holes that they own, and Siam Country Club is an LPGA Tour event venue as well, but different golf course, but. It's golf is very big here, and you can see that that they do a good job of looking after good players and turning them out and giving them every chance to succeed. And then you occasionally stumble across a tire who takes it and runs with it.
We've not seen anything like Lydia Ko since Lydia Ko. She's that special, I think, a tire, is that she's got that Lydia Ko. In fact, she's the second youngest ever world number one. I think Lydia was 17 when she got to the world number one, which is just
correct.
Staggering. Yeah, she was 15 when she won the LPGA, the Canadian Women's Open, with 19 of the world's top 20 ranked players in the field that week.
Lydia Ko.
At 15 years of age.
And was it 14 when she won the New South Wales?
14 when she won the New South Wales. The year after she lost a playoff for the New South Wales Women's Open.
That's right.
Age of 30.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. Which is just at Oatlands, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and she's nearly at swing coach number 15 as well.
Yeah, well, that's so true.
Just sacked another one. So.
And is she mid-20s yet, Lydia? How old is she, 26?
She's over 25 and plans on giving it away by 30.
She
gets married in a couple of weeks to a very well-to-do man from Korea who's the son of some credit card tycoon. So,
bit of gossip. Yeah. I didn't expect this segment. I might get some music for it. Gossip. What's happening around the place? Fascinating stuff. Just while we're talking about that, talk a bit about the culture of golf. For those who haven't been, golf in Asia is very different to what we see here in Australia, isn't it? What's it like over there in Thailand? Have you played much golf in Asia? And what do you see there that's clearly different to what we see here in Australia?
I've played a little bit of golf over here. I haven't played golf in Thailand, I must say, but I played a little bit around some other parts. It's very different. I mean, the Thai people in general, but golf in Thailand is the most respectful place on planet Earth. There is nothing someone can't do for you and help and everything like that. Even down to the caddies we mentioned before, they're the club caddies who are there and do these amazing jobs. These young women who push clubs around or go around in the cart depending on what golf course, and they know yardages, they bring clubs, they fill divots, they get golf. Like it's a to give it some context, I think to be involved in golf in Asia, you're first given an education in golf. So your grounding is not just hit a ball and you enjoy it, so keep doing it. It kind of, there's a lot more to it. And it's a game, I think, that it's run and owned and supported by very wealthy people, but the players aren't necessarily those people. So, you know, in Thailand, for example, Singa Beer is the biggest sponsor of junior golf in Thailand. So you'll notice any good young player coming out of Thailand will often have a Singa logo on them. It's because Singa Beer basically props up junior golf. And that couldn't happen in Australia, an alcohol company sponsoring junior golf. But
be against the law, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly right. But they, and I was talking with one of the journos who discussed staying at a house at an open, I think it was, with the Thai journos, and Mr. Singa came past, and he was the most, you know, the guy running the golf division of Singa. I don't think he was Mr. Singa, but he was the most generous guy and so interested in golf and wanting to know about the young golfers and who they were. And there's a real bond in the players that come from here. Like, you know, Kiradek Afibanrat and Prom Misawat are still best friends from being, you know, young golfers together. And I think, you know, it's very unique and very, very different. The golf is very different. I mean, Thailand, where they play golf, is incredibly flat. So you learn to play quite different golf, but it's probably why some players don't succeed overseas as well. But they produce a huge number of quality players that go and play, you know, men's and women's golf around the world.
My limited experience of golf in Asia, Logue, would be it doesn't feel like the way golf looks here. There's not much in the way of public golf, municipal golf. There's a course down the street where
who's it for? Who's golf for? A question I always think of.
That's exactly right, because the only experience I've had really has been resort golf. And what Jimmy talks about, there's a caddy, there's all the trappings of golf are a part of golf in the golf that I've played in Asia. I don't know whether that other golf does exist. Do you know? And is that healthy?
Yeah, I don't know. It's also very highly accessorized. Like, there's no such thing as like a casual game of golf, is there? With where you just that's right. And the equipment, like, you're just right into the equipment, aren't you? If you're a golfer in Asia, maybe that's, you know, a little bit of an archetype. But I lived in Japan for a little while. I never played golf. I went to a driving range. I was there for like 2 years, and I went to a driving range once. And they thought I was some sort of touring pro or something. I had a massive crowd around me watching me hit balls. But for a lot of people in Japan, that was golf, was just going to the driving range, because the golf courses, and I think this is still pretty much the case to this day, the golf courses are outrageously expensive. And there is no such thing as a casual game of golf at those golf courses. It's a full-day sort of experience.
Isn't there a bath in the middle and a lunch? And there's a whole ritual.
There can be in Japan. Yeah, there can be.
In Japan, if you do it properly, it's
lots of meals and stuff.
The whole scene.
That's right. And then in the suburban areas, there are less, like, not the full-blown country club type of golf courses. Like, I only realized this years after leaving Japan, that I noticed, like, where I lived, I looked and there was one of these sort of canals that ran through, it was a river that had sort of been shaped into a man-made canal, and it was lined with golf courses. And they were, to say that they were similar sort of courses to Marrickville doesn't do Marrickville justice. They were, like, really, really flat, just played on.
Is there not a very
like soccer fields?
Isn't there a different form of golf in Japan? It's played with a
park
big
golf. Yeah,
yeah.
This isn't region. Park golf. These were proper golf courses, okay. But terrible architecture, just basically on playing fields. And they look to me like a little bit more accessible form of golf than these country club courses that are out in the forest, just, you know, around the fringes of Tokyo. But I looked up, and the membership fees at these places were outrageous, like really, really expensive to go play golf on like a flat paddock next to a man-made river in a suburban area of Tokyo, but completely out of reach of the normal golfer. So
we've got such an abundance of land here, don't we? And the US is the same, that you kind of take for granted that you can have golf in the suburbs as part of your growing up experience. It's just not true for so many places in the world. And you've got to wonder whether actually trying to import golf into those places would in fact be a healthy or good thing.
Yeah. And I wonder how it translates into this phenomenon of women's golf being super popular and the huge interest in watching golf in Japan, because they're not all playing golf, that's for sure. Like there's that.
So my theory that golf survives on people who play being the ones who watch.
Invalidates your theory.
So Gillis wins again.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I hate that Gillis. Yeah.
Are we not also accepting that some of the people that were at that tournament in Japan early this morning were there to see Ewan Porter?
I think that'd be a stretch, personally, and I think Ewan would agree with that's probably a stretch. But I really did think that was was very interesting. It's an interesting observation from Ewan, but it was interesting to see just there really were that crowd is a surprisingly large crowd, even for a hometown hero. And you might have seen that for maybe Greg Norman at the Australian Open back in the 90s or the late 80s that would happen. And maybe a similar thing to that. But
she's a genuine phenomenon, though. Like, I know Japanese people living here in Sydney who know nothing about golf, but they know
Hinaka.
They know her. She's got a clothing line and, like, she's a huge phenomenon in billboards everywhere.
I think that ties into beyond just golf in Asia. I think professional golf in Asia is much more an entertainment prospect. It's not just for golfers; it's for everyone because, there's not the sports like rugby league and soccer and the games are played here, but the professional leagues aren't what they are in countries like Australia. So, something like a golf tournament is a huge event, and if the country has a big player, that's a huge thing. But I think to get back to golf in Asia, it's again like the countries in the area. It's so diverse and different in all these places. You know, that I spoke to the chairman of the Asia Pacific Golf Community this morning, and he spoke about the first time this year there's a woman from his home country, Pakistan, playing the women's amateur Asia Pacific. So, the golf culture in Pakistan compared to the golf culture in Japan is going to be something.
Very true.
So many of those smaller countries we talked about earlier last week, these players that play grew up playing on courses that were set up at places like Air Force bases or, places where expats would come and work and they'd set up a little sand green course to play and pass the time, and the kids happened to live nearby or their dad worked there and they went and played. And so that's their version of Marrickville.
That makes total sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how they get their touch on it. And then those countries may have a country club or whatever, and they get their access to then play there. But I think the introduction to it is very different. The driving range is golf for a lot of people, which that ties in with my world idea of golf is that anything that's golf is golf, and where it leads to it, it can be anything, really.
You're right. We do, of course, make the mistake of thinking of Asia as this amorphous blob that's all the same. It's actually not.
Golf in China is completely different.
Japan and China, you couldn't find Vietnam.
Surge in, I think, what you were thinking of, a lot of resort.
That sort of golf touristy golf.
Yeah, and some very good golf course architecture being put down in Vietnam as well. So interesting sandy sites and stuff. So
interesting stuff.
It's fascinating being at these events, and there's not a huge amount of journalists here, but there's a few from different areas, and I had dinner with two of the guys from India last night. We were talking about, like, India is on the verge of having three Champions Tour players at some stage soon, with Jeev Milka Singh, Arjun Atwal and Jyoti Randhawa. Like, I can't imagine that when these guys started writing about golf a long time ago, that was ever a prospect they would think about. And that let alone have teams in an event like this, which is unbelievable, but it's so varied that's the thing. You talk to some players who are just so happy to be here and to get to wear a national team shirt, or some players who have played so many national team events that it's old hat to them, which is the uniqueness and beauty of it, really.
Very, very interesting stuff. And again, I think this week, the tournament you're covering, the Asian Amateur Women's Championship, will probably be one of the most interesting to watch. So recommend that. I assume it's on TV here. I haven't had a look at the guide.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is on TV there, I believe.
Yep. Turn it on, have a look at
it. We'll look out for you on the coverage.
I got my head on the opening tee shot last week after you asked me to get on the coverage load. I was right there. So, you know.
Very good. What's the food like in the media centre there? Is it the being looked after?
Now for the big questions.
Are there any meat pies?
Sausage rolls? What's the go?
There's not meat pies, but we've been sharing player dining for these 2 weeks. It's very civilised. Huggy and I would adjourn for lunch and sit up there and, you know, discuss.
Well, next year, Melbourne for the men's.
The food hasn't been the strongest part of my personal trip, I've got to tell you, so...
Next year back at Royal Melbourne.
We don't want any details on that.
No, we don't. Next year back at Royal Melbourne for the Asia Pacific Amateur, which we must mention. That was a big announcement made last week, which we hadn't talked about. And when they were in Royal Melbourne in 2014, I covered the Asia Pacific Amateur. You could go and order cappuccinos at the bar press for free.
I went to Royal Wellington. Staggering. For the Asia Pacific Amateur in Royal Wellington.
Unthinkable.
It was just in the clubhouse. It was lovely. Yeah. But I felt bad about sort of sitting there and having to all the teams were at their own tables, right. And there was no sort of table which was just full of like media or computer people. I was there as a computer person.
Were you the awkward kid in a cafeteria?
Yeah, it felt really awkward. I'd like, you know, intrude on a team to find a place to sit and eat, but it was nice. The food was lovely.
There'll also be an announcement of where the women's event is on Sunday here as well. So the women's event will go back to March, which is when it typically was.
And does that mean Australia for that as well? Is it always the same country for both?
No, it's not. It has been the last couple of years. But so the women's event will be played in March. The men's event will be played in November. So it could well be. I'm not sure. I just know that the announcement is coming on Sunday. I thought we might have something today to talk about. But, yeah, no, Sunday will be the announcement. But, I mean, I hope the women's event comes to Australia as well. That would be fantastic because, you know, the chance to watch one of them or both and maybe go to another state outside of Melbourne, because Royal Melbourne will be incredible, of course. And, you know, Huggy joked he might struggle to get the assignment because there'll be plenty of people putting their hands up to go to Royal Melbourne.
It certainly will.
There's plenty of places around Australia you could play this week's event, and yeah, you know, it'd be absolutely awesome. Because, I mean, one of the things here is, you know, and we saw it with the live event in Bangkok, not a huge amount necessarily go to watch the golf in Thailand, depending on what it is. It's also hot. So, you know, to take it to a place where the girls who may not have futures in professional golf, where they would get to play in front of a crowd, would be really, really a cool thing to do. And that'll be the case for the men next year at Royal Melbourne, where people just show up. You know, I spoke to Tony Rule, the captain there, and I said, you guys host so many events for, you know, top golf courses. So it's in our charter to do so. And the members love doing it. Yeah. And they hang around and they watch and they, you know, they like their club to be used for what its purpose is, which is to play golf
and championship
people at
golf.
A high level playing it is good.
Important golf tournaments, as
and it holds
says.
Up.
Yeah, oh, absolutely it does. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that should be a directive to so many top clubs around the world that, you know, you have something special.
Share it.
Give other people the chance to use it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, interesting. All right, I think I'm done. Anything else from you?
No.
You haven't found any more statistics that are going to get us to next week?
No. I'll report back on that.
You'll find something for next week. Thanks for joining us. Enjoyed that live. Thanks for your for coming in.
Thanks, Rod.
Jimmy, good of you to beam in from, well, it's not the other side of the world, is it? From just a bit further north of here, but in another country. Good of you to take some time. Have they already hit off? Is it the tournament started, is it not? Have we got any scores? Anything?
It sure has, yeah. Kelsey Bennett was in second at 5-under.
Wow.
With Liana Jurisic of Malaysia had a course record 66, I think it was, this morning. So, the afternoon wave is out there now. So it's all happening. And I think five of the Aussies went off this morning and three of them broke par and one was even par. So, yeah.
If you had any questions about how good the players are, you don't fluke rounds of 5-under. No. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you've got to be able to play.
Here's a good one for you. Sarah Hammett, who's in the field from Australia, she's 15 years old and she had 1-under today.
Wow.
I mean, this is
turn up in another country,
course.
Shoot 1-under.
Wow.
And you're not wrong. 99 holes at Siam Country Club. It's a big golf course. There's 99 holes.
But it's spread across the country, is it not, Jimmy? That's the thing. Is that right? There's a couple of different venues.
Well,
it's not.
You've got Waterside where we are this week. Just up the road is the old course, which is where they play the LPGA. Right, yeah. Nearby to here is one of the other ones that name I cannot remember, that's the 27 holes. And then there's now also Siam Country Club Bangkok, which is as the name would suggest, near Bangkok. That's the most recently opened one. So, and Rolling Hills, I think, is just down the road. The bus takes us past that. That's supposed to be the best course in Thailand, from what I understand. Right. So, okay. Yeah, but I'll be preparing to jump in front of a champagne cork on Sunday for the winner so that there's no deaths.
Take one for the team. Good of you.
Well, that's how I'm going to get on TV. Yeah, fulfilling right. all of Logue's instructions.
You'll be doing the Dustin Johnson is what it's going to be called from now on. Anybody who smacks himself in the face with a champagne cork. Thanks for bringing us some news from the ground, Jimmy. Been a joy to talk to you, mate.
Thank you. Been fun.
Episode 121, done and dusted. We'll be back again next week with all the news here on the Good Golf Podcast.